The Danceology Podcast interviews the great masters of dance, the working professionals starring in today's most exciting shows, and the rising stars ready to amp up the craft. I'm your host, Edita Slavinska from Dancing with the Stars. Join me as I dive into the world of dance, uncovering unique stories and the fascinating personalities of industry professionals on Danceology.
Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
A hippie movement formed in California in 1968, founded by a man who called himself the last end time prophet. These colonies would spread to 15 countries, all spreading a message of salvation and revolution. But their frightening apocalyptic messaging was nothing compared to the atrocities that were happening within its communes. This is the Children of God on today's Cult Following. Hey, everyone. Welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Hi. Hey, Dr. Katie.
Hey, how are you all?
Good, good. We haven't recorded since before Christmas, so it's nice to have the gang back together. How's everyone's New Year going?
It's going well. Things are moving along as they should. How is everyone else?
Katie's been super busy at work, but Lisa, we have Dr. Katie and I actually recorded since you went to Germany. How was your Germany trip?
It was amazing. I loved it. We hit a lot of the Christmas markets across Germany, a few in Austria and France, and they were very picturesque. They kind of reminded me of Hallmark movies. Everything was decorated. And the day that we landed in Munich, we got 18 inches of snow. So everything was gorgeous and white. And I loved it. I had a ball.
We were jealous. We mentioned you at the top of the episode that we did that you wouldn't be joining us because you're off on some expedition to German Christmas markets.
Yeah, it was great.
You're supposed to bring us all back ornaments, I think. Did you do that?
I did not do that. I'm sorry. I think I had too much mulled wine and forgot.
That sounds lovely, though. 18 inches of snow. That's quite a lot.
Yeah. We were the last plane to land. The day that we landed in Munich, we were the last flight they let land that day because of the blizzard that came in. So,
oh, wow. Well, just made it. I'm glad you made it.
Yeah.
Are you all watching any cult content on Netflix or Max? I noticed they've dumped a lot of new programs.
I haven't recently. I watched the documentary on the Children of God, but it's been a couple months now. That's the last one that I was able to watch.
Katie, have you been tuning into anything?
I have not, unfortunately. I've actually not watched a lot of anything recently. I know there have been a lot of things that have come out. I recently just watched the movie 1917, which I think came out like 5 years ago. So that shows you where I'm at. It was great, though. But no, I'm going to have to catch up with some cult documentaries and movies on the streaming apps now that the holidays are over.
It seems more popular than ever. As we're recording this today, Crystal Heppner's book has come out. It's the second day it's been out, and it's number two bestseller. And she, you know, blows the lid off Playboy being a cult, which I think we're going to cover ourselves in future episodes. So that'll be interesting. I have not read that yet. It's in my queue of books to get, but I haven't gotten into it yet, but I'm curious to see what her perspective is on it, being she was really one of the last generations of centerfolds and certainly Heppner's last wife, and again, her take on it all.
Seems like it's perfect timing for us to cover Playboy.
For sure. For sure. But today we're going to cover the Children of God, though. So Lisa, you want to kick off with a little bit of an explanation on what the Children of God was?
Sure. So The Family International is a Christian cult that was founded in Huntington Beach, California in 1968. It was originally named Teens for Christ, and then it later gained notoriety as the Children of God, or the COG, which is what we're going to focus on mostly today. It was later renamed and reorganized as the Family of Love, which was eventually shortened to just the Family. And it's currently named the Family International.
Interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting roots there. I have a lot of thoughts about that. But just to give you a little more information, so church members founded communes, first called colonies, in various cities. They would proselytize in the streets and distribute pamphlets. According to the Children of God, there were 130 communes or colonies in 15 countries by 1972. In 1993, 7,000 of the 10,000 members were under 18 years of age. Recent statistics by the Family International puts full-time and fellow members at just over 11,200 members in over 100 countries, and around 4,000 adult full-time members and 4,000 children. Some estimates have placed the total number of people that have passed through the group at 35,000. But there, unfortunately, there just aren't really any reliable statistics. The group doesn't open its books and records to third-party verification or public scrutiny. I'm sorry, it doesn't open its books and records to third-party verification or public scrutiny. Trying to keep things a little secretive, which always raises red flags for me. It has also published exaggerated figures regarding the number of people reached with their message, using overlapping statistics to show numbers exceeding the population of local regions and even the entire world.
The Children of God initially spread a message of salvation, apocalypticism, spiritual revolution, and distrust of the outside world, which the members called the system. The Children of God's founder and prophetic leader, David Berg, was a former Christian and Missionary Alliance pastor who gave himself the titles of King, the Last End Time Prophet, Moses, and David.
Dr. Katie, I think I say this in every episode, but we've seen this before with leaders of cults and their flashy titles. Again, for people that haven't, you know, listened to other episodes, these grandiose titles, is this symptomatic of something with these people, or is this simply an organizational structure?
You know, I think the more we look at this, the more, like you said, there's a lot of overlap, and there are always a lot of possibilities, right? We only have so much information, and so we can't necessarily diagnose the people that we're talking about with anything with the information that we have. But, you know, that grandiosity can be a piece of narcissistic personality disorder. It could be delusional, depending on how the person is actually viewing themselves. I think either way, when I was reading about this cult and thinking about this piece, especially since it comes up so often, you know, what is the point? What is the purpose of this? And it seems to me that, you know, this is just a really good way to get people to follow you and kind of place yourself in a position above them so that they can begin to become indoctrinated into this culture that you've created as a leader. Right. And that's a good way to limit the possibility of somebody speaking out against you. If you take something that they're already familiar with, that generally for a lot of people has a positive connotation, like the Bible. Right. So if you're placing yourself at the same level of influence as certain biblical figures, or if you're calling yourself the same name or saying that you're this person reborn, that's a good way to kind of, again, place yourself above people and possibly limit their feelings towards you that might be negative, or the questions that they might have come up. They might be less likely to have those or to speak out if you're kind of putting yourself on that same pedestal as some of these people from the Bible.
Something that occurred to me when you were talking about that this, we're going to get into this in a little bit about all the children that were in this particular cult and what happened to these kids. But it occurred to me that, you know, I think that human beings, Americans, whoever around the world, are kind of accustomed to learning about leadership figures, maybe subconsciously, even from being little. I mean, you know, your parents are in charge of you when you're a little kid. You know, the teacher is the head of the class, right? Like, they're kind of controlling things. You know that a person that wears a badge is an important person. Like, without even really understanding it, maybe when you're little, you already know who authority figures are. Does that make sense?
Right, it does. And so that, yeah, that's also what I'm speaking to, right? The that power differential. And it's important if you're going to try to get people to follow you unquestioningly, to place yourself at the very beginning at a position of very high power and influence.
And even if you're little and you go to church, you know, the pastor, the reverend, the priest, they're in charge of the congregation. So that must work for adults in the same way, that they're still sort of programmed in these, you know, for these leadership figures. So when you call yourself Moses, David, the last in time prophet or king or whatever, you're definitely putting yourself above everyone. And that's a system of control, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think another thing that came up when I was looking at this too was, you know, the paranoia potentially about the rest of society, so to speak, right? And what might lead people to stray from that.
Sure.
You know, and if you're already kind of separating yourself out in that way, then you might be more likely to fall into this role of following someone that is also kind of trying to deviate from the norm of society, but also attaching themselves to, you know, somebody that is from the Bible, that is in this place of power, influence in a positive way, as you knew it formerly.
Right, right. Some of the cornerstones of the Children of God included the notion that God loves sex because sex is love, and Satan hates sex because sex is beautiful. An interesting kind of doctrine that they had there. Exploiting the free love movement of the 1960s, Berg encouraged adults in the Children of God cult to have sex with children, reportedly with those over the age of 12. However, there have been allegations of much younger children participating. Berg was an advocate of sex with minor age children because he wanted his child to embrace sexuality, to be a sexual being as an infant and while growing up. Ugh.
It seems like they were targeting children from the very beginning. And I know I mentioned this earlier, but this, what you were just saying, just kind of triggered something for me that I'm not sure if anybody got to see that documentary. I believe it was on Max, on the Children of God, but it was essentially like the Children of God created these music videos, and they were primarily for internal purposes, aiming to reinforce their religious teaching and ideals among its members. And the videos often featured songs with lyrics promoting the group's beliefs and lifestyle that were very clearly geared towards children. And I found them to be quite disturbing, and I wrote down some of the lyrics from some of the music videos that they had clips of. So one of them, it has children in the videos. They're singing and dancing and marching and doing chores. And then they're singing, "When someone says, close the door, you close the door." And then there's all these kids chanting in the background, "You do it right now. You do it right now." And then there was another one where they said, "Do it because daddy said so. Daddy knows best. Daddy knows best." So I don't know. It's very clear to me that they were very calculated with what the children were exposed to, and that they wanted to indoctrinate them young, to teach them to submit, not to ask questions, to kind of blindly obey. And one of the ways they did this was with their kind of fun sing-along videos that they showed the kids.
That's interesting.
So, aside from the illegal nature of pedophilia, could you discuss pedophilia, Dr. Katie? Is it a mental disorder, or is it just more of a criminal activity?
So pedophilia is a mental disorder that is listed in the DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And so there are certain criteria that you have to meet, right? If you're actually being diagnosed with a mental disorder. So for pedophilia, it has to have gone on for at least 6 months. And it has to include recurrent or intense sexually arousing fantasies, sexual urges or behaviors involving sexual activity with a prepubescent child or children. So usually 13 years old or younger. So, you know, the technical term pedophile, it depends on how old the kids were that they were using in this cult, right? There's also a hebephilic type, and a phoebophilia, which is more like 15 to 19 or 11 to 14. So you can kind of separate it out. Generally, when we're talking about pedophilia, that's, again, prepubescent children. I can't talk today. So the other piece of this is that the individual has had to have acted on these sexual urges, or the sexual urges or fantasies cause marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. So there has to be some kind of problem that this has created in their life in one way or another. And then the person that has engaged in these acts, or beliefs, right, or fantasies, has to be at least 16 years old, and at least 5 years older than the child or the children that they were fantasizing about. And so, you know, there's a difference between people that are having difficulties with this in their life, and people who might have a sexual attraction or preference for children, but this isn't causing any kind of psychosocial difficulty for them. That would not be a diagnosis at that point.
Dr. Kitty, I have many questions. I think I might have zoned out on one part in there. You talked about a difference in age. So like a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, that pedophilia, or is it, you know, would two 14-year-olds get together? Like, how does that dynamic work when you're not really an adult by the letter of the law?
Right. So again, if you're falling under this diagnostic category of pedophilia as the child or the victim, you have to be prepubescent. So usually, again, around 13 or younger than that. And the person that is committing the acts has to be at least 16 or, you know, and at least 5 years older than
gotcha.
The child.
I see. Okay.
So if it's, you know, a 13 and a 14-year-old, that doesn't really fit this criteria, even though that could still be an abusive, sexually predatory situation. Just speaking to this specific diagnostic criteria, that would not fit.
Sure. Dr. Katie, if someone comes in to see you in your practice and they admit pedophilia, do you have to call the cops on them?
I do. Yes. I have to make a report. I am a mandatory reporter. You know, especially if they have specified someone. Yes. There are channels that we go through to try to make sure that we keep everyone safe, especially the people that are being victimized.
Wow. And when you go confess that to your Catholic priest, they say, can I get their number? No, that's terrible. Oh, man. Father Dan's going to kill me for that one. I do want to add a little bit more to this. Again, not condoning pedophilia in any way, but the general ideals behind the hippie counterculture movement, we've seen a lot of these cults we've talked about this season have come out of sort of the 60s, the early 70s. They've been hippie cults. This one also seems like it's a hippie cult that evolved. This free love movement of the hippies did involve minors. I don't assume maybe many 13-year-olds, but, you know, historically, even famous groupies were 13 and 14 years old following bands around. So there was a different nature to young kids at that time, kids wanting to escape their families at a very young age. this isn't a defense for it, but does this factor into it at all? Maybe more of an acceptance, Dr. Katie, do you think, or Lisa, is there anything to that, that the culture of the day would have influenced this?
I mean, I think it's never acceptable, right? I think this is a hard line in the sand that no matter the time period, the culture, this is just not acceptable. If you're, again, an adult and you're acting in a predatory way on a child and trying to victimize a child, it doesn't really matter when it happened. Now, I think it could have possibly been made easier earlier, you know, back in the 60s or 70s, like you were discussing, if children could more easily run away, like you said, or, you know, they wouldn't have had cell phones. They didn't have a way to try to reach out or contact somebody or escape if that was going on. So it probably was easier at that time. I think for me, that's just
acceptable. Do you think that kids were more adult in the 60s and 70s? You know, I know what I was like growing up in the 70s, and people that I ran around with, like, does it make sense that kids might have been more adult when they were minors then versus like what you see with the Gen Zs now that are like so coddled and don't want to leave home and, you know, don't want to really attempt to do anything and they're babied more into their 30s? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it just, again, I think, you know, if you're generalizing people, then that always creates a problem because everybody has a different situation, right? We have to look at each individual person. I mean, you could say in a lot of ways, Gen Z or the younger generations now are also more adult, right? They've got access to a lot more things on the internet. They're not necessarily as sheltered as they once were because they have access to the internet and more media. And they, you know, want to emulate these people that they see that are adults a lot of times. So, I mean, I think you could argue either way. I think that's too hard for me to land on. I think, again, you got to look at the individual person.
I think, though, they did a really good job of isolating people from outside influences. So they had strict control over the information, and then they're using psychological manipulation. And I think in that documentary, it said that they wouldn't even let the kids read. They didn't even want them to read. So their options for reaching out for help had to be extremely limited when they're not even capable of reading and got in trouble for reading and punished for reading.
You know, and more to that point, Lisa, the Children of God wasn't just a hotbed for sexual abuse. There were also apocalyptic and communist aspects within the foundation of the Children of God. Members lived together in their communes. They banded together around the concept that an apocalypse was coming and that they were martyrs with the power to save the world from the Antichrist. To earn money and food, members would resort to street performances and begging for groceries. They allegedly were only permitted to keep 10% of whatever they earned. The Children of God was actually abolished in February of 1978, or at least the name was. Berg reorganized the movement amid reports of serious misconduct and financial mismanagement. The group's abuse of authority and disagreements within it, and particularly about their continued use of flirty fishing. And I thought, I've never seen this term before. This is very interesting what they were doing. Flirty fishing was a form of love bombing. Flirty fishing encouraged female members to enter into sexual relationships with potential converts. In some areas, flirty fishing used escort agencies to meet potential converts. What do you guys think of that?
I think that's really sneaky. I mean, using the escort agencies, I think a lot of times people that tend to find their way into being in a cult tend to usually be lost or looking for something. And I think you could almost say the same thing for people that are going to an escort service. So that's probably a great place to go look for potential members.
I guess if you're promising people they're going to get laid to join the church, there's probably going to be a lot of takers.
Especially Nail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this obviously just to me seems to be another really calculated manipulation tactic, right? I think these people, Berg and the people that were at the top of this Children of God cult were master manipulators. I think that they were very calculated about what they were doing. And it seems pretty clear to me that they had a lot of ulterior motives. I don't think that they were even trying to mask what they were doing here.
You know, I want you to talk for a minute about the dynamic between the church leader and the follower asking them to even perform this activity. You know, what kind of person could do that?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this speaks to somebody that likely does not have a lot of empathy or remorse. They're not thinking about how this is going to impact the people that they're asking to do this. And, you know, let alone the people that they're trying to bring in. And the question is, you know, like Lisa said, are these people that are vulnerable individuals already, are they seeking those people out? And again, kind of preying on a certain kind of person.
Right, right. Lisa, you have some more data on this, don't you?
I do. So from 1974 until 1987, church members had sexual contact with 223,989 people while practicing flirty fishing.
Wow.
They were putting in work.
That was all from one girl.
Well, so it's interesting because they believed in the concept of flirty fishing where the female members, I think it's interesting that it was more the female members were encouraged to engage in sexual relationships as a tool for recruitment, but it also contributed to the high number of children within the group. So not only are they like recruiting new members with this tool, but they're getting more children that are in turn going to be added to the list of victims later.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Wow. Crazy. I'm going to add a little bit more to this. The group was accused of sexually abusing and raping minors within the organization with considerable evidence to support this claim. In Panton Hill, Victoria, that was a location of one of the communes where a large government raid occurred and many children were removed by social services. That was in Canada. The group's liberal sexuality, its publication and distribution of writings, photographs, videos, advocating and documenting adult child sexual contact, and the sexualization of children led to numerous reports of child sexual abuse. A major judicial investigation in 1995 found the family to have had a highly sexualized environment for children, with abuse at significantly higher levels than the rest of society at large. 1/8 of the total membership left the movement. Those who remained became part of a reorganized movement called the Family of Love, and later just the Family. The majority of the group's beliefs remained the same. And again, you know, Dr. Katie, this is something that we've seen over and over again. You know, there you get some bad press, you change the name, but the foundation of it stays the same. This went on for a very long time. You know, we're looking at this group being around from the early 70s all the way into the 80s. So we're looking at a 20-year span of time. What was the number that Lisa had? 223,989 people for 40. This goes on over years and years and years. This is crazy.
Just for the flirty fishing too. And that's just the numbers that we have available. Like you said, they weren't necessarily, or like we talked about earlier, they weren't necessarily opening records and, you know, books for everybody else to be privy to. And I also wonder, you know, how many people in the community were in positions of power or people that, you know, were mandatory reporters and they were involved in this as well. So, you know, that's also concerning to me if you think about it at that level too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So just a little more. When the Children of God was renamed, part of their new doctrine acknowledged the early mistakes, particularly when it comes to sex with minors. A grace period was given to members who were having sex with children within the group because no policy was written forbidding it prior to the name change. So church leaders admitted only that some children were abused from 1978 until 1986 and created policies prohibiting excessive discipline and sexual contact between adults and minors. Those found to have abused children after December 1988 are supposedly excommunicated, but their crimes are also allegedly often left unreported to the police.
Mm.
Well, in a now exposed secret directive, the current leader, Karen Zerbe, declared in 1993 that child adult sex is not inherently wrong. She explained that although they were forced to show outsiders that they were complying with the law, members should not lose sight of what they truly believe on the inside. And to deny culpability and uphold its image makeover, the family required members to leave the group if they wished to report child abuse to a law enforcement agency or if they want to pursue legal action against an alleged abuser within the group. So, as a result, they can technically say that no members have reported any sexual crimes as of late. So they essentially built in a loophole. If you want to report abuse, you can't do it as a member.
I think one of the most fascinating things about this is that when Karen took over, this is a female issuing these statements and potentially believing what Berg had. And, you know, And maybe, Dr. Katie, you can speak more to this than I can. You often maybe associate pedophilia with males, but you don't often hear a female talk about it. What do you think about that? What do you think about Karen issuing the statement?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's a good time to just kind of highlight and bring up the fact that, you know, men, males, people that identify as men are also victims of sexual assault and child sexual abuse.
You hear about like the high school teacher sleeping with a student. That's what you hear when it comes to like, you know, the female pedophile, right? Like that's all I can think of.
Right. And I think it's been glorified in some way. There's been kind of a fantasy that's created about this, but you know, when you think about it, these people are still victims. There's still emotional, physical, psychological damage that takes place. And so, yeah, I mean, not every person that could be diagnosed as a pedophile or has those tendencies is male. And so it's definitely important to remember, right? That can be just as damaging if the perpetrator is a female.
We don't have a lot of data on Karen here, but Karen was fairly dangerous in this movement.
That's what I was going to say. I wonder like what Karen's background was. What was her childhood like? You know, did stuff happen to her as a child and maybe she normalized it in her own mind or... I don't know. I would be interested to find out more data on her upbringing.
For sure. So I'll kind of start to begin to wrap up a little bit about this cult. Berg communicated with his followers via letters of instruction until his death in late 1994. He published nearly 3,000 letters over a period of 24 years. In a letter written in January of 1972, Berg stated that he was God's prophet for the contemporary world. After his death, his widow, Karen Zerbe, became the leader of the Family International, taking the titles of queen and prophetess. Karen Zerbe married Steve Kelly, an assistant of Berg's whom Berg had handpicked as her consort. Steve Kelly took the title of King Peter. Consort, King Peter. Huh, there's a joke in there somewhere, I guess. And became the face of TFI, speaking in public more often than either Berg or Zerbe. So his widow takes over, and then the widow's consort takes over. Oh, so a interesting power dynamic there.
Yeah, definitely. So the group has been criticized by the press and the anti-cult movement. In 1971, an organization called FreeCog was founded by concerned parents and other people, including deprogrammer Ted Patrick, to free members of the Children of God from their involvement in the group. Academics were divided, with some categorizing Children of God as a new religious movement, and others labeling the group as a cult.
I think what's interesting is it was originally named Teens for Christ. So I feel like they were targeting children from the very beginning.
Yeah, I agree. I think everything we've talked about, right? This seems very calculated. To me, this seems like a way to try to very poorly cover up, kind of a child sex ring. That's what it sounds like to me, more so than anything else. And, you know, speaking to what we just talked about a few minutes ago, maybe when Zerbe came in, they thought, well, maybe a woman is more approachable, right? That could also be part of the manipulation even. But this is pretty sinister. This was a tough one to read and learn about and kind of revisit.
And this one wasn't even just in North America. It was up to 15 countries were involved in this. And I'm sure in other countries, it might've been a little easier to maybe get away with stuff. I don't know. That's a pretty widespread 15 countries.
Yeah. And we don't really have any data on whether there was a financial component to this. All we talked about earlier was that some of the people in the group were begging for groceries and things of that nature, begging for money. So we don't, you know, if this was a cult that was getting rich, which we normally hear about when that happens, that's one thing. But this seems to be just like the children are just cattle in this, it seems like, especially with those early numbers, how many kids were actually in this. It's a lot of kids that were potentially victimized here.
Yeah. And that raises the question again for me. How were there this many people? How was this group this large and this widespread and no one in a position of power to do something about it did anything about it, right? How did this go on for so long?
They may have been involved.
Right. And you know, so, I mean, all conspiracy theorists, but I mean, you do have to ask those questions, right? How was this allowed to go on for so long and pretty much be an open secret?
This was pretty much over by the time the internet ever came around. The internet shines a huge spotlight on things today. But pre-internet, this stuff was all very isolated. If you didn't get it in a newspaper or a magazine, you just didn't know about it. I also believe that the communities that these things were, like I can speak for the small town that I'm from in Indiana, and how many worldwide headquarters of cults there are in that little town. Not to mention just how many churches there are in such a small footprint of a city. Tons of churches, which I write about in my book, how many there are. And what's fascinating to me is in a small town like that, you know, people in political power, judges, police, are members of some of these movements. People look the other way when there's someone in power. So if one cop is in your pedophile church, you might just put the blinders on for the rest of the cops to look that way. You know, it could be a simple matter of that. Does that hold water? Does that make sense to you all?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for if there were people in positions of power in, you know, regular society, that if people in the groups or professions that they were involved with knew about it and felt like it was easier to just turn a blind eye, you know, especially culturally at that time, I do think it might have been less likely that you'd be wanting to pry into somebody else's business too far and get yourself involved. So I think that's a possibility, right?
Also, the idea of religious freedom and people kind of stay away from that sometimes. They don't really dig into churches unless they absolutely have to.
I think it would also be interesting to find out what this particular, what Children of God's beliefs were with birth control. Because if they had their women out there sleeping with over 200,000 people, I mean, you can get young children by bringing in new people, but when you're out having that amount of intercourse, that could result in a lot of children.
Maybe their initials shouldn't be COG, but STD.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was another thought that I had. I hope that they were taking people to a doctor at least at some point.
The hippie counterculture movement was pretty much responsible for all our modern day STDs. That's where it evolved from, right there. This, just a little postscript to all this, you know, this group did have a few notable members. Jeremy Spencer was a blues slide guitarist and founding member of Fleetwood Mac. Wow. Christopher Owens, a musician from the San Francisco indie band Girls, was brought into the Family International by his parents. Celeste Jones and Christina Jones, co-authors along with Juliana Burig of Not Without My Sister, an autobiography detailing extensive abuse they suffered in COG. This book is used by the organization RAIN as a reference for child sexual abuse victims. Juliana Burig herself is the first woman to bicycle around the world and co-authored that book, Not Without My Sister. Most famously, Rose McGowan, the actress Rose McGowan, lived with her parents in a COG group in Italy until she was 9 years old. She described her COG childhood with memories of being beaten by cult members and recalled how the group advocated for sexual relationships between adults and children. River Phoenix and his family, Joaquin Phoenix, Rain Phoenix, Summer Phoenix, all actors, were members of the group with their sister Liberty Phoenix from 1972 to 1978. River Phoenix, of course, was the famous actor who died of a drug overdose in 1993. He had told Details Magazine in a November 1991 article that that church was ruining people's lives. Susan Justice, an American pop rock singer, songwriter, and guitarist, known best for her debut self-recorded album, The Subway Recordings, was a member. And Ricky Rodriguez, who was the son of Karen Zerbe, he was subject to the suppressed COG manual advocating child adult sexual contact. He committed a murder suicide in 2005. Killing one of the women who raised and allegedly sexually abused him and then killed himself. Former members spoke out after the incident saying they had witnessed Rodriguez having sex with his own mother.
Whoa.
Karen Zerbe. So, interesting group of people. I don't want to think that a founding member of Fleetwood Mac was having sex with children, but maybe. There's definitely the Hollywood and musician pedophile rings. Rose McGowan, of course, famously later had all her issues with Harvey Weinstein. Imagine what the trauma that poor girl had, not only being a minor in this cult, potentially maybe having sex with adult members of the cult, but then having to experience this again with someone like Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the research shows us that people that are victims of sexual abuse as children are more likely to be re-victimized again later in life. So yeah, very dark. This one was tough.
Yeah. Lisa, I'll let you take us out.
Okay. So thanks for listening, everyone. Be sure to rate and review this episode. You can find us on Facebook at Cult Following Podcast and on Instagram at Join the Cult Following. If you have any questions or comments for us, you can send them to jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com.
And I'll see you next time.
Yep. Until next time, keep following.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something.
And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Everybody, I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith, and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.